Roman numeral 10 on this, commandments or ethical issues related to the protection and preservation of life. And this is the question of euthanasia, literally good death. Literally good death, because EU is the Greek word for good, and thanatos is the Greek word for death. So literally good death, popularly called, it's called mercy killing. All three terms are misleading, because they're trying to sanitize what is, I think in many cases, just wrongful putting someone to death or murder. But let's get into that. Point A, main point, it is wrong for us actively to take our own life or the life of someone else. Why? Because the Ten Commandments say you shall not murder. And if we keep that in mind, it will help us solve some of the difficult problems that arise with end-of-life issues. The Bible tells us not to murder. And that doesn't mean you should not murder anybody except yourself. It means you shouldn't murder yourself either. So that's our general approach. There is a narrative section, the beginning of the book of 2 Samuel. And people disagree on whether this applies to the question of euthanasia or not, but I think it definitely does. This is a background. God has chosen David as king. The anointing of the Holy Spirit for kingship that was on Saul left Saul and came on David. But Saul still wanted to be king, and he wouldn't give up his kingship. And then when David kept receiving God's blessing in battle after battle and in the people's honor and recognition, Saul started chasing David around the country, trying to kill him. He threw his sword at him and tried to kill him one time and sent army after him. He's trying to kill David. But the Philistines attack Saul. His son Jonathan are defeated and killed. And then a messenger comes and tells David what has happened. And here's where the story picks up, 2 Samuel 1:1. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. And David said to him, "Where did you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" This is massive, because if Saul is really dead, David is going to be king. And the young man who told him said, "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And we looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' I answered him, 'I'm an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.'" So Saul had been wounded by the archers. He knew he couldn't survive or escape. He fell on his spear, stabbed himself through the stomach, tried to put himself to death, but it didn't work. He was still alive. And so he told this guy, "Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers." Now look, this is a situation of terminal illness. There's no reasonable human chance of survival. He's going to die. He might die a very painful death, because if he doesn't die quickly, the Philistines are going to come and they'll probably mock him and torture him, and further suffering is going to be involved. So this guy says, "So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And incidentally, I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I brought them here to my lord." So this guy's thinking, "David, you're going to like this. I'm bringing you the crown. You're going to be king. Maybe I'll be, you know, prime minister or something. Who knows?" He's quite excited about this. "Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." Remarkable. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I'm the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." And David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called to one of the young men, one of his soldiers standing by, and said, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. Not the result the Amalekite was expecting. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Now, there are some complications with this passage. First, people go back a few pages, or just a page in the Bible. They go back to the end of the previous book, 1 Samuel, where the story of the battle occurs. And they see that there is this story of Saul and Jonathan being defeated in battle and being killed. And it doesn't mention that this Amalekite was there and took the sword and finished off Saul's life. So some people say maybe this guy's making it up. And you know, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. I don't know how you can tell. But it doesn't matter because, let me say a couple things. First, he knew Saul was dead. And second, he had taken the crown. So he was right there in the middle of the action. So it's plausible that he's telling the truth and that the end of 1 Samuel just doesn't tell us all the details. But the second thing is, David accepts it as true, whether it's true or not. This is the messenger that's come from the battle. David takes him at his own word. And he passes judgment based on it. So I think this situation, number two, is similar in several ways to cases where people say euthanasia is justified. A, the patient was terminally ill. He'd been wounded by archers and he fell on his own sword. And he had no reasonable human hope of recovery. The patient was in extreme pain and faced the prospect of more suffering. And the patient requested that someone actively put him to death, help him die. And not only was just any old person saying, "Help me die," it was the king. The king was commanding someone, "Help me die." So it's kind of a command of the government, too. Yet King David, whom the Bible says is a man after God's own heart, 1 Samuel 13:14. He holds the Amalekite messenger morally accountable for killing Saul, and he says, "You have to die." He imposes capital punishment on him. This, it seems to me, gives significant narrative confirmation of the rightness of applying the command, "You shall not murder," to the question of euthanasia. Now, when I bring that up, and I've talked with, I remember one or two other ethics professors in various informal conversations I've talked with, and they say, "Oh, no, this is different. It's the king. You can't make a general case about euthanasia for all people from this passage." My answer is, why is killing the king any worse than killing another person? Aren't we all in the image of God? That is, the image of God is not less in other people who are not kings. Their lives aren't any less valuable to God, nor can we say that common people's lives deserve less protection than the life of the king in God's sight. Therefore, if it's wrong to kill a terminally ill king who requests it, it seems to me it's wrong to kill anyone else who requests it. And then another ethics professor would come back and say, "Well, you know what? It really wasn't that he committed murder. It was that he rebelled against the king, the Lord's anointed." And my answer to that is, David specified that he had killed someone, not that he had rebelled. In fact, David never punished people for joining against Saul. David was in rebellion against Saul. People were coming and helping David to maintain his protection and his force. David wasn't punishing people for rebelling against the king. He was punishing people for committing, he was punishing the guy for committing murder. And so I think it is a valid application of this passage to say, David, a man after God's own heart, says, "You put someone to death who was terminally ill and in great pain and asked for it. You killed a human being made in the image of God. You deserve to die." That's, it seems to me, the conclusion from that passage. Now, how does that apply to the political and moral situation we face in the United States today? Well, number one, this is point B, physician-assisted suicide continues to be a threat in the United States. Michigan had great difficulty in stopping Dr. Jack Kevorkian, nicknamed Dr. Death. He had He'd been tried four times without being convicted because he helped people and actively promoted that he was helping people commit euthanasia. Finally, he administered the fatal drug himself on a public television broadcast, and he was died, and the person died, and Dr. Kevorkian was finally, in the fifth case, convicted of his role in the case of voluntary euthanasia. He served 8 years of a 10 to 25-year prison term, and then he was released on parole in 2007, and he eventually died in 2011 at age 83. In the Netherlands, the right to die has quickly slipped into the obligation to die, and a number of, and I don't have the exact numbers, but it's because it's a little hard to tell, but many, many elderly and ill people are put to death against their wishes in the Netherlands now, and it's a very big concern. Once voluntary euthanasia is established, then you're costing us a lot of money. You have an obligation to die, and, wait a minute, I don't want to die. Sorry. And that's a very troublesome trend. And so it's a slippery slope that we should oppose. Point C, we must maintain a clear distinction between killing and letting die. And if you just want to circle that, killing and letting die, those two things are different. Killing means actively doing something to a patient that hastens or causes death. Letting someone die is passively allowing someone to die without interfering with that process. And I think it's always wrong to kill someone, but not always wrong to let someone die, which is not the same as killing. So that's the distinction I want to make. Well, how do you know the difference? Well, point D, we should try to help and not allow someone to die when there's a reasonable human hope of recovery, when we're able to help. For instance, if someone has a heart attack, or a person is drowning, or in an auto accident, or a person planning to jump off a building, the commands in Matthew 22:39, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, and in Matthew 7:12, whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets, mean in those kind of cases, we should try to help someone, and so the person would not die. But on the other hand, point E, it seems to me that there are other kinds of cases. It is right to allow someone to die when this is the patient's wish and there is no reasonable human hope of recovery, where it's a situation of futility. It may be also that there are times when we are unable to help. For a person in a burning car where you can't get into the burning car because the flames are so severe, you're unable to help. Or it may include times when we cannot afford the extraordinary expense of some medical treatments. Point four, when someone wants to die and the end of life is near, I think it's okay for the person himself to pray that God would take his life. Luke 23:46, Jesus said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And Acts 7:59, when Stephen in the early church was being stoned and he knew he was dying, he said, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. It's okay for us to pray the same thing with the person and for the person. Jesus, it says in Hebrews 2:14, partook of the same things, flesh and blood, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. So we shouldn't, if we're believers, we shouldn't fear death, and we should be freed from that fear of death. So allowing someone to die is different from killing someone. Allowing someone to die might include not starting a life support system or stopping a life support system. And then point C, there is much difference of opinion among Christians over a third category, stopping or not starting a feeding tube, what's called nutrition and hydration. Nutrition meaning food and hydration meaning water. So I remember when I was younger, my grandmother in Minneapolis, when I'd go to visit her in a nursing home, she was old, she was frail, And she was just praying that she could die. And I just wondered about that, but it seemed like it wasn't wrong for her at that time. And I was able to pray that she'd be able to go to be with the Lord. Now, more recently, within the last year or 2 years, my dad was 95. He was in a nursing home in Florida, and he was frequently saying, "Lord, please let me die," because he was more and more frail and wanted to go to be with the Lord. And he did, as many of you know, pass away just on December 18th last year. With the situation of his last illness, he had had a very bad experience a year or two before in our hospital there in Orlando, and was just had gotten more sick and almost died, and he just was very clear that he didn't want to ever go back to a hospital again, just be kept alive artificially. So the nursing home called me and said that he had experienced quite a rapid decline. One of my brothers was nearby, went to see him. Another brother went down to be there as quickly as he could. And they started hospice care, and my dad kind of declined so that when people were speaking to him, he wasn't speaking back or responding or saying anything. And this went on for more than a day. He was in a double room, he and a roommate that shared the room with him. And when they started hospice care, they were going to wheel him out of that room into a single room so he wouldn't have the roommate and the television and things. So they started to... So the nursing home had called me and said, well, we could send him to the hospital. I said, what would happen there? Well, we'd artificially, you know, put a breathing tube and feeding tube in him, and we could prolong his life. And I said, that's exactly what he's told me many times. He does not want to happen. Okay. So he hadn't been conscious or responding for a day or two. I can't remember exactly. And they were going to put him in hospice care. They were wheeling his bed out to take him to another room, a single room, and when they wheeled him out of his room, he kind of sat up quickly and said, "No hospital, no hospital," and then then he lay back down on the bed. So, I mean, making his wishes clear, yes, it was without question. Point F, we should do what we can to alleviate the patient's pain, love for one another, and doing for others what we would have them do for us. The first consideration in that case is the patient's wishes. There may be a trade-off between alleviating pain and remaining conscious and rational and alert, and the patient himself or herself should decide this if possible. Now, here comes a complicated situation. What about the double effect where a very strong painkiller such as morphine will alleviate pain but also tend to hasten death? I think in that case it's right to ask, what is your primary purpose in giving the very strong painkiller? Is it to kill the person, then you shouldn't do it. But if it's to alleviate pain, then I think it's all right. Point G, it will save our families a lot of stress and trouble if we give clear directions about our wishes ahead of time. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So we should all complete a medical power of attorney designation. And look, Margaret and I have done this. If I become terminally ill, it isn't three people or all my family who's going to make a decision. It's one person. It's Margaret. And if Margaret's unable to make the decision, it's one person. It's our oldest son. And if he's unable to make a decision, it's our next oldest son. So that is, it isn't a committee deal. It's too confusing. And Steve Oman set up our estate plan for us and our medical power of attorney materials. So we gave clear directions about our wishes ahead of time. And we should verbally communicate those wishes clearly to our family and friends. So a few years ago when Steve Oman got these documents together for us, the next time our family was together, our three kids and their wives, we sat down with them and walked them through these documents and said, here's a copy, here's what we've decided, and we wanted you to know this. I think love for neighbor should also lead us to be organ donors. Point three. Now, my own personal decisions. If I'm no longer conscious and no longer able even to pray, and there's no reasonable human hope of recovery, would I want a large amount of effort and expense on hugely expensive medical equipment being put forth to keep me out of heaven? What do you think? No, I do not. Then when I'm ready to go, I'm ready to go. Paul wants either life or death, but he doesn't want to be suspended between the two. He says, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. The desire is to depart and be with Christ in Philippians 1:23. For that is far better, but to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Sometimes in Scripture, God's people set their affairs in order and just calmly would die. Like in Genesis 49:33, Jacob drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last. And we need have no fear of death. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? In 1 Corinthians 15, we talked about that last week. So that's the end of that. I have 2 minutes before I'm going to turn it over to Steve Ullman. So any correction or comment? Steve, do you want to come up and get ready for this? And do you have any comment or question or clarification on that?
Wayne, I normally don't interrupt you, but there was a comment, a good comment. If you're donating your brain when you die, we have people lining up for it.
First. Okay. I didn't say this. Steve Ullman has been a friend for a number of years. He started out his professional life as an engineer. He was an engineering graduate of the University of Minnesota and worked as an engineer for a number of years. I don't know how many.
About two.
Two? Okay, but he worked. And then went to law school in Minnesota as well, William Mitchell College of Law, and he's been practicing business law and estate planning law, particularly here in Arizona for many years. And he's done our estate planning, and he did my dad's. And I'll tell you, when my dad passed away, everything was so simple and smooth and straightforward, all the financial materials, because Steve had done a great job in setting it up. So... okay.
Well, thanks, Wayne. I appreciate the opportunity to come up here. Thanks for those kind words. Before I get going, let me just mention a couple of books that this one I hope to talk about a little bit. It's by Ron Blue, Splitting Heirs, and giving your money to your children without ruining their lives. Hopefully we'll get to that. I got a bunch of stuff before. And this is another good book, The Christian Guide to Wills and Trusts. I'll leave them up here so you can look at them. I got my good friend at ADF actually put me onto this book. Let's see. These slides are going to keep me on track, I hope. Without them, I won't know where I'm going. In any event, first a little scripture. 1 Timothy says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, is denied the faith, worse than an unbeliever." The word provide there might scare us, say, do we have to take care of everybody financially? No. Provide, hopefully we can catch it all. It means to consider in advance, to plan. So it's admonishing us to plan for death in our estates and whatnot. But what happens if there isn't any planning? All states, all 50 states, have intestate succession laws. Those laws basically say who gets your property when you die if you don't have a plan in place. I've said that, so it will always be a court-supervised procedure. Even though you don't have a will, you still go through a probate, but it's the statute that will say who gets what. And similarly, if you don't have powers of attorney in place, as Wayne was mentioning a minute ago, a medical power of attorney, or in a durable general power of attorney, one that deals with economic issues, then you can have other court-supervised things, like a conservatorship. That's where someone is going to be appointed to take care of your assets if you can't. Now, you might say, well, my wife can do that. Yeah, she's first on the list, but she may or may not be the person, or maybe you don't have a wife or a husband or somebody else. There's a whole list of people that can do it. Again, it's court supervised. You have to do regular reports. And if you don't have a family person that's going to qualify under the law, you wind up with a public fiduciary, somebody who doesn't know you at all. That can be good, can be bad. Similarly, that was dealing with economic issues. Similarly, dealing with issues of your person, what kind of medical treatment, where you're going to be living and so forth, you might need a guardian. And again, it's going to be a court-supervised proceeding to appoint a guardian for you. Public reporting regularly, open to the public. And there's a list of candidates that could be, as I mentioned. That's kind of in order. Spouse, majority of adult children, parent, a domestic partner, a sibling, or a close friend. Getting into talking about property, we should understand, at least here in Arizona, we're a community property state. So when you're married, you have either community property or sole and separate property. And you hear all the time about joint tenancy. That's really not a third category. That's really a sole and separate property that has a built-in statutory provision that upon death it goes to the surviving joint tenant. This is the statute that starts talking about. So I think I skipped the slide here. Yeah, first, the community property. What's community property? It's basically everything that you receive while married. It doesn't include, though, gifts and inheritances that may come to you while you're married. The other type of property is everything else. Sole and separate property, it's everything that you had when you got married, what you bring to your marriage, as well as gifts and inheritances. And increases in either one of those things remain the same. In other words, community property remains community. When I say increases, I mean rents, royalties, interest, or any growth. Similarly, for sole and separate property, once sole and separate, it stays that way. You can transfer back and forth freely between spouses. You can make sole and separate community and community sole and separate, and there's no tax ramifications to that. I mentioned intestate succession is what happens if you die without a will or some other planning mechanism. This is the beginning of the statute that says what happens. And it breaks it down as to whether or not all of the kids that are left behind of the surviving spouse are also kids of the decedent. I'll make it simpler here in a second as to what this all means. If there are no kids from a previous marriage, then of the decedent, that is, then the entire estate goes to the surviving spouse. If it's a blended family scenario and there are kids from a previous marriage, then that's not the case. If there's kids from previous marriage, then half of the decedent's separate property, their sole property, but none of the community property would go to the surviving spouse. Okay, where's it go? Before to understand that, there's a concept called right of representation that you have to understand. And it's a complicated thing, but it has to do with levels, children, grandchildren, and so on. It's easier to explain with this. If the decedent dies leaving three kids or having three kids, one's alive, and it says that just off the screen. The red guy there is alive. And then the dark ones are dead. Who gets it? Well, one-third, one share would go to the child in the red. His child, where he has one child, doesn't get anything because it went to the father or the mother up above. The two deceased children's shares go to their kids, but not by the branch. They get recombined so that each one of the grandkids there, of the five descending from the dead children, each get a fifth of two shares. That's by right of representation. So having said that, this is the property now that doesn't go to the surviving spouse, goes to the decedent's descendants by representation. I'm going to go through this fairly rapidly because it's real complex, because it's real in the English, first to the kids, and then by the grandchildren by right of representation, second to the parents, third, the brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, again by right of representation. Fourth, aunts, uncles, cousins, right of representation. If none of those exist, state gets it. So when people say, oh, if you don't have a will, your state's going to get it, well, not really, unless there's nobody else that can get it. And of course, if you have no one else and don't want the state to get it, you need a will or some kind of document that's going to give it to whoever you want to have it, like the church or whatever. Some bad planning examples. People regularly give large gifts and they don't report them. The problem with that is that there is such a thing as a gift tax. If you exceed the thresholds for those, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, and don't report it, later on it's discovered and you're going to owe large taxes. It could be a 40% rate. And penalties and interest and everything else. So people give gifts without reporting it. You have to be careful with that. Another one is transfer into joint tenancy with an heir. I hear this all the time. Somebody has a home. They say, I'm going to avoid probate. I'm going to put my son, my daughter, my grandchild, whatever, on my deed with me. I put them on so when I die, they get it automatically. Well, you just incurred a gift tax, probably, of a significant amount. That heir, that child or grandchild's creditors, if they have judgment liens or some other thing, they just attach to your property. And you lose your step-up in basis. What we're talking about there is when a person dies and assets pass on to their heirs, the heir has a new tax basis. Basically, they can sell the property, and their tax basis would be the current fair market value at the date of death, so they can sell it and not have a tax gain, even though you might have had the house for 20 years and it's worth a lot more. By giving it away, you lose that benefit. Instead, you wind up with the donor's tax basis. And then the last problem here, if you're in a situation where you're trying to qualify for state aid, LTACs here in this state, and you give property away, there's a 5-year look-back period so that the state will not support you or provide any support until you've used the money that you gave away. And you don't have it anymore, but you still don't qualify for, you take the number of months that would have been paid by that gift, and you simply don't qualify for that. So it's bad planning. Wise estate planning is just the wise use of tools available to handle your resources, to be able to give it to your heirs without tax shrinkage. And your estate includes everything. Everything that you own, your sole property, your sole separate property, community property. Sometimes people forget about things like insurance proceeds or their IRAs and pension plans. All that is part of your estate, and it's taxable. Oftentimes you hear, well, insurance proceeds aren't taxable, right? Yes, they are. Not from an income tax standpoint generally, but for an estate tax standpoint. So what kind of taxes? Again, estate tax. These are transfer taxes, basically. It's not a tax on what you own per se. It's a tax on what you're transferring. So estate taxes, gift taxes, and another one, which people don't know very much about, generation skipping transfer tax. If you think about it, if you have a large taxable estate, I'm going to skip my kids. They don't need it anyhow. I'm going to give it to my grandkids. That's a generation skip. And Congress isn't going to let you do it if you have a large enough estate to have more money than is available in an exemption. And it's a significant tax. It's 40%. The exemption amounts, though, are up quite a bit. This is the current law as a result of the fiscal cliff deal. It's pretty good. Everybody can give up to $5.25 million to anybody right now without paying a tax. That's a personal exemption. 10 years ago, when Bush was first elected, it was back about $600,000. And while he was in office, a law had been passed, and it was marching up. And in 2009, it was $3.5 million. 2010, the tax went away. 2011, it was going to either be $1 million or they had to do something about it. And they made it, instead of $3.5 million, they went to $5 million. And it was going to expire again at the end of 2012, but the fiscal cliff deal renewed it, and it's inflation adjusted. That's why it's $5,250,000. If you're above that, though, it's 40%. It's coupled with the gift tax, so you either give it away while you're alive or at death, you're still going to get nailed with the tax. It's 40%. But the exemptions are the same. Now, in the gift tax arena, there's an annual gift tax exclusion, which we're all familiar with. This year, it's $14,000. Without that, you couldn't give a Christmas gift or a birthday gift to somebody. Basically, any gift is taxable unless there's an exemption, and it's the $14,000 annual exclusion that covers that thing. You don't have to file a tax return or anything like that if you're using the annual exclusion. And that GST thing, again, is now over $5 million, but it's a 40% rate. Basic tools to try to avoid some taxes, but also to just handle your estate when you die. Wills, whether they're testamentary, trusts that are included, or just simple wills. POD accounts, that's payable on death. You might have a bank account or brokerage account. You can even have a car now that transfers automatically at death. living trust, which I'll talk about some. Durable general power of attorney, that's, I mentioned earlier, that's the power of attorney that you're appointing somebody to handle your financial assets while you're still alive. And medical power of attorney, which Will has spoke, Wayne has spoken about. There's tons of other stuff. We got a whole alphabet soup full of various things, but they're more advanced type stuff. Charitable remainder trust, insurance trust, flips, or it's a family limited partnership, and so on. There's lots of tools. We also have a lot of joint or non-probate transfer mechanisms. These are things that happen automatically without having to go through probate and without having to have a living trust and so forth. I've mentioned joint tenancy or, in this state, community property with right of survivorship. Community property is a pretty unique thing. It has, I mean, just a little aside, it has a very good income tax provision. If you have just joint tenancy and not community property, and joint tenancy is not community property, one person dies, the other person inherits the half that the decedent owned. They get the step up in tax basis that I mentioned earlier on the half that was inherited. They don't on the half they already had. Community property, just a nuance in the law, the whole thing gets a step up in basis. So owning property as community property is a good deal. Anyhow, we have community property, the right of survivorship. Now that right of survivorship thing was added about 6-7 years ago. We have payable on death accounts that I mentioned. Beneficiary deeds is unique. Arizona is, I don't even know if there's another state that has them. If there is, it's maybe one or two. This is a scenario, instead of grandma giving her, putting her child or grandchildren on their deed with her, she could do a beneficiary deed of trust. It's a regular deed, it gets recorded, but it's not effective until death. When the person dies, you just file a death certificate and the title automatically transfers. You get the step up in basis, everything that would normally happen through a will happens with respect to that property. That way you can revoke it anytime you're alive and whatnot. It doesn't have to stay there. It's a nice provision if you don't have a will. Then, of course, beneficiary designations on insurance policies and estate plans or 401ks and so forth and living trusts. Okay, what can a will do? Well, you all know that it can pay your, it's going to pay your debts, it's going to pay your taxes. Then it starts distributing property. You can either distribute property by including valuable, tangible property within the will that goes to whoever you say it goes to, or Arizona, as well as most states, allow for a separate written list. So you can have a list that doesn't have to be witnessed, doesn't have to be notarized, last list counts. So you can update it whenever you want. Wills, trust, they both can employ that feature. And, of course, it just moves the rest of your property around. You're going to name the person you want to be your personal representative. That's the executor, known most of us, called personal representative these days. If you have minor children, you're going to name a guardian for your minor children in your will. Give whatever powers are necessary to the personal representative, and you're going to establish trusts if you want to do that in your will as opposed to a living trust. You can waive bond so you can avoid the expense. If you're picking your personal representative, someone you know and trust, no sense wasting money on a bond. And if you happen to have been the custodian for somebody, for a child, under the Uniform Transfer to Minors Act, you can name a successor custodian if the document appointing you didn't do that. What it can't do, can't distribute non-probate assets. In other words, anything that transfers automatically at death, insurance policies, things that have 401ks and IRAs and so forth that have beneficiary designations, they're going to transfer automatically. Joint tenancy property with right of survivorship transfers automatically. This thing I mentioned a minute ago about community property right of survivorship transfers automatically. Doesn't go through probate. That stuff. It's not going to be able to reduce the state taxes. And you can't avoid probate with a will. It has to be probated. That's how they become active. If you have a special needs situation, in other words, a beneficiary who was either already receiving assistance due to age or a child who's not going to be capable of handling money, the will, you wouldn't want to just die and have the property transferred to that person. It's going to knock them out from a qualification standpoint for the assistance. You use a special needs trust or, more properly, a supplemental needs trust. And this will is not going to do you any good in managing assets while you're alive. They're only effective at death. You use the powers of attorney to manage them when you're alive. So a living trust is just a mechanism. It's an agreement, basically. It's a document that's usually an agreement with yourself or a husband and wife with themselves. They're the trustors, the settlors, the grantors, different names for it. They create the trust by transferring property to the trustee, who's usually them, and held by the trustee for the benefit of the beneficiaries, them. The reason it works, so it's not just an agreement with yourself, is that there are contingent beneficiaries. When they die, there are children and grandchildren and whatnot, so it's a document protecting other people ultimately. And it avoids probate. The same person, as we just said, can be all three positions. You can create it in your will, it's called the testamentary trust, or you can create it during your lifetime. Therefore, then it's called an inter vivos or a living trust. We commonly hear it referred to as. The reason you would do it, a living trust is, among other things, to avoid probate. If it's in your created only in your will, you're going to go through probate to get it done. So it decides what happens. Typically, it's the trust is set up in a fashion where it says who gets what, not your will anymore. You'll see in a minute you still have a will, but it's there. It also can be revocable or irrevocable. In other words, most of the living trusts are going to be revocable, amendable. If you change your mind, do something, or some change in circumstances, you can always amend it, at least as long if it's a husband and wife in a joint trust, as long as they're both alive and well and competent. At a point when one of them isn't, it may not be amendable anymore. It depends on how it's drafted. And they're not just for the wealthy. You can certainly hand minor children. If you have minor children and die, you don't necessarily want an 18-year-old receiving a bunch of money. If you want to hold it in trust for a while, you're going to need a trust. Or you hold it from them for a while, you'll need a trust, not just a will. There's a lot of flexibility and control. It allows you to manage all your assets in one spot. It protects you during illness and incompetency. You know, how's that work? Remember, you can have an economic power of attorney, but then you have to have convinced the bank or the stock brokerage company, whoever it is, that the power of attorney agent is authorized, and that sometimes can be difficult. If, in fact, your assets aren't in trust and you're incapacitated and your successor trustee steps up, they have no choice because the successor trustee owns the property by law. In trust, of course. It continues because you can have a death if you're running a business, if you're doing whatever that's owned by the trust. There's no hiccup. It just keeps right on going. Avoids probate, like I mentioned. How that works is probate is only a mechanism. It isn't a tax thing. It's just a mechanism to move assets from a person who has died onto the heirs. Person isn't there any longer to sign deeds and so forth. So you know, who can do that? Probate is just a court-supervised procedure for that. By putting your assets into a living trust while you're alive, you don't have any assets that are going to be probated. That's the function of it. They're private because you don't post them anyplace. If you go through probate, your will is going to be filed with the court and it's open to public record. The trust typically is not, unless you get in some kind of battle or something. You choose the law with some flexibility. If we're here in Arizona, we're probably going to use Arizona law as the law that governs how it's organized. But you can choose to have another law, state's laws apply as long as that other state has some connection, whether the trust or beneficiary or assets are owned in the other state. You literally can employ other laws. Arizona's fine. They're less easily challenged than a will if you get a will contest. Will contests, nobody knows what's in the will. It never happens. It doesn't get activated until the death. You're gone. You can't defend it anymore. If somebody doesn't like what they see, they may bring an action challenging the will. We're in a living trust scenario where you may have been dealing with it for years, actively have your assets in it, less likely to be challenged successfully. It coordinates the whole thing. There's a whole lot of other things that come together, all the alphabet soup and so forth. The trust more easily than a will can coordinate that stuff. You can qualify whoever you want as a trustee, even an out-of-state person if you have a child living elsewhere. You can possibly handle income tax savings, that community property thing I mentioned. If you use a joint trust, you can do that here in Arizona. So is it hard to get it all set up? Not really. You have to do, obviously, some paperwork. Set it up in the first place. You got to take the time to transfer the assets in. If you're talking about real estate, that's actually filing a deed. Vehicles, Department of Transportation has to retitle the deed. Banks, brokers, whatnot. Hey, I want my accounts held by the trust. You jump through a few hoops. Banks typically will have you take property out of a trust if you're going to refinance it. They don't have to, but there's something that most trusts have called a spendthrift clause. We'll talk about that in a minute, but it basically prohibits creditors from reaching assets. They get like that possibility, so they have you take the property out, put a new finance and new mortgage, deed of trust on it, and you stick it back in. That's a bit of a hassle sometimes. But, and as I mentioned, does it protect property from creditors? No, not for you guys, not for the person who makes the trust. You can't put your own assets into a trust and sequester them from your own creditors. They can reach it just as easily because you can. Assets in a trust at death are reachable if you have a bunch of creditors and there aren't sufficient assets outside of your trust. Those creditors can get paid from the trust assets. But if you're going through a probate anyhow, you're going to notice all the creditors. And after 4 months for some creditors, or 4 months basically if it's done properly, those creditors are cut off. Beneficiaries are shielded from their creditors. Now, I mentioned you can't put money in the trust and shield them from your creditors, but if your beneficiaries, your kids and whatnot, their creditors can't reach the assets that you leave for them. A famous example in Arizona is our past governor, John R. Symington, or his wife, Ann. They inherited tons of money. They got in trouble with some real estate developments, got a bunch of lawsuits against them. Those guys couldn't reach their assets because they were put in there by, I think it was Ann's family, and so they could not reach the assets. You still need a will, because you may have assets that aren't placed in the trust. So you might have won the lottery. Somebody won a couple hundred million last night, I guess. Of course, nobody here would play that, but it's... But if maybe something, you simply have assets, you haven't got it into the trust, you still need a will. It's called a pour-over will, and it pours assets into the trust, basically. And if you have minor children, again, as we said before, you're going to name guardians in the will anyhow. Moving on to the durable general power of attorney. This is where you're naming somebody to handle your assets when you can't or aren't available. They can be limited or general. Limited to say you just want them to do one thing. You see that every now and again with somebody out of town when buying or selling a piece of real estate, got to have somebody else sign for them. Or general, they can do anything and everything. It can be temporary or permanent. They can be effective upon execution. All the agent needs the piece of paper that says they're the agent. Or they can be springing. In other words, upon somebody's incapacity, then it pops up. I use both types, and it depends upon the circumstances. Sometimes we'll do the wife or the husband have an absolute capacity, kids springing capacity upon the disability of both the principal and the spouse. They're not called the agent, or you've always heard the expression attorney in fact. It doesn't have to be an attorney, just attorney in fact is a power of attorney holder. Why have one? It might be convenient, as I mentioned. You're going to be out of town, unavailable, have to have something done. Or because you might become incapacitated and you don't anticipate that, but you become incapacitated or are out of town and nobody knows where you are, thrown in jail, whatever. You need to have somebody manage your affairs. And as we talked very early on, without this kind of planning, and that situation arises, you're going to have to go to court and get someone to a conservator appointed for you. But you get to choose your own agent if you do it yourself and what their capacity or abilities are. We'd refer to it as a durable power of attorney because it's durable even though the principal is incapacitated. Under the common law, when these things originated, the agent can never have authority greater than the principal. So if the principal was incapacitated, the agent couldn't act. The agent was incapacitated, exactly the opposite of what we want to have happen. So by statute, we have this durability feature You have to claim it, but it's there, which means that even on the incapacity of the principal, the agent has authority. But it does terminate at death, so it's not a will substitute. Once the principal has died, the agent has no authority. They can't pass on assets under it at all. Who? Obviously somebody you trust, somebody who's capable, who knows something about your assets. I usually see family members, but you obviously can't use a minor because this person is going to have legal capacity to enter into contracts and so forth. You can have multiple agents, but if you do, you should point out how they have to act. Are you talking unanimous action? Can any one of them act if there's or a majority? Your choice. You want to name successors. The idea is to bulletproof these things. So that if you and your agent named both go down for whatever reason, then you want somebody to back up to be able to step up. What kind of powers? There's a whole list of stuff there, anything from selling and buying real estate, personal property. The bottom one, transfer property to a trust you've already created, is important. The trust can't have jurisdiction over assets it doesn't own. If you're trying to avoid probate, you get incapacitated, it didn't complete the job, and have a power of attorney, that person can transfer the asset into the trust for you. And of course, they're always required to act in the best interest. Now, healthcare, which is what Wayne kind of asked me to talk about in the first place, we finally get to it. There's various directives here that are possible. This is where we're making decisions when you can't and you're out for some reason. Everybody, all 50 states allow for it. And there's different kinds of them, and they have little different functions, although a lot of overlap. Things, living wills, healthcare proxies, powers of attorney. It's your expression of what you want to have happen when you can't. For example, Wayne was just talking about what he has in the situation where you're in a terminal condition, being artificially maintained, no chance of getting better, so to speak. Do you want to pull the plug or not? A living will is the type of document that deals with that situation. Again, use of food and hydration. It's a separate question. You can take out an artificial respirator and still live. A few years ago, we're familiar with Terry Schiavo case out of Florida. It was a big deal for quite a while going on. She was basically brain dead, but being maintained for years. They got in a legal battle over it. Finally removed the feeding tube, and she did die. You can wind up in a vegetable condition, basically, if you have feeding tube in, even though you're basically dead. It doesn't mean that you're going to be denied medication for pain, as Wayne was saying. And it doesn't affect the situation. This is living wills now. It doesn't affect the situation where you're not dying. In other words, you can't pull the plug. We don't have euthanasia in Arizona. You can't terminate somebody's life if they're otherwise curable. And the determination of whether your agent has power to do anything is a medical decision under the living will. It's not up to the agent. If the doctor thinks he's just going to cure you, then the agent doesn't have any authority, just the doctor. Healthcare power of attorney is another situation here. This is where the agent is given authority to make medical decisions that are not only when you're dying. You could be in an accident, illness, whatever, unconscious, but going to recover. You want an agent to be able to make medical decisions when you can't. Again, single or multiple. Wayne mentioned his are seriatim, one after another. You can do it however you choose, though, too. You can have all your kids involved, one like committee decisions or just one of them. It doesn't matter. And again, it's the medical professions who deal with the medical aspects of it before the agent has any capacity. If you have capacity, your agent doesn't. If you're making your own medical decisions, your agent doesn't kick in. What good are they? Well, obviously, it makes your preferences known, tells the physician who they should consult with, who's going to call the shots, prevents family members from having to make choices when that they're not ready to argue about, particularly if they're in that scenario. And lets the guy know who to talk with. Downton Abbey, we all watch that, right? It's your Sybil's death. There was an excellent example of where a medical power of attorney would have been useful. You know, what sort of treatment and who's going to make the decision? The whole Downton Abbey's an estate planning presentation. I like to combine the healthcare power of attorney with the living will. And so I put all the name an agent that can make the medical decisions and the living will provisions, which you've selected, pull the plug or not, feeding tube, yes or no. That's all part of one document so that it allows that agent, rather than just the doctor having a cold, say, do this, to make the decisions. You know, it keeps up to date. If there's changes, things going on, they can go there. Again, you want to pick the right person. If you have a healthcare power of attorney, that agent can also put you in a what's called a level one behavioral health center, basically a lockdown. That's an Alzheimer's scenario going on because you're conscious but you're not capable. You have to be concerned that your agent has the ability to reach your medical information. HIPAA is a federal law that prevents anybody from seeing your medical information without your permission. And you can include funeral and disposition information. If you didn't have a power of attorney, again, this is a statute that has people in that order of listing having the capacity to make medical decisions for you. So, I mean, the statute is there. These are surrogates they're referred to as can make certain decisions. But they can't put you into a level one behavioral center any more than 48 hours. They have to petition to court for any kind of a longer stay. As I mentioned, this Ron Blue book. I don't know if I should keep going here or not because I think my time is up. So.
I'd like people to be able to ask any questions. Do you want to kind of show them what's on the remaining slides without talking about them?
Ron Blue talks about... It's getting into what's really behind it, not all the legal stuff, but what should you do? You're giving it to people, charity, governments, transfer wisdom before wealth. Charities, you can't take it with you. You can send it on ahead, and where your heart, your treasures, or your heart will be also. This is an interesting topic. Do you have to treat your kids the same? Should you? The answer is no. Love your children equally and therefore treat them uniquely. These are quotes from Ron's book. You have to consider how your gift is going to benefit or injure the child. Are they going to make them useful or less useful in life? If they have problems, addiction and whatnot, it could be a real problem. Timing, he basically talks about maybe it's time to give it away while you still have it. When you're alive and you're not dead, you can see how they do with it. You can impart your wisdom and knowledge with them, to them. How much is enough is talking about. How much do you really need before you start giving it to somebody else? As we talked before, you got to watch out for tax implications. Gifts are more efficient than estate transfers. It has to do with how the tax is applied. I won't go into the detail, but it's just they're more efficient. If you're giving kids while you're alive, you can watch them, teach them, see how it goes. Don't be manipulative about it. This is just good advice here. Gradually, don't change their lifestyles. Got to respect the husband's need to support a wife or the wife going on there. Respect your kids' wishes on your grandkids. You know, don't go past them and respect God. If God's trying to teach them something, stay out of the way. Okay. If I keep going, I'm going to go into a different arena. So, if there are questions, I'll give it a shot.
Hi, we have a trust, but we've neglected to entitle our house as part of the trust. Would the pour-over will that you mentioned cover that, or are we in trouble?
Well, without seeing it, for sure. Okay, I'm not sure what it would say, but likely. Usually when a trust is put together, the attorney would also have you do a will, and it's likely a pour-over will. I'd have to look at the specific document.
Steve, we just learned something. Wayne's aunt's husband just died in November, and they'd been married 60 plus years. And when he died, her credit card was canceled because they've also always had a credit card together. And she found out, I just want to encourage you women, when you're jointly on a credit card, I just got my own. But so that if something happens to Wayne, I still have something to use.
Big drop.
Yeah.
And I told Kitty, and she said, oh, I've had one for a long time. So I think it's really important.
Is that right, Steve?
It's likely right. It depends upon the credit card issuer what their rules are going to be. Everybody has their own credit standing. If someone typically dies, I don't know why they would shut off a credit card, but I don't doubt that they did. Everybody has their own credit standing, though, and it's a good thing to have the ability to carry on, certainly.
How often should you have your estate looked over or renewed or reviewed?
It's typically recommended every couple of years, but it really depends on your own circumstances. If your family has changed, new kids, whatever, that's changing in your own planning, then, of course, you want to take a look at it and see what it says that needs to be changed. Outside things that you may not know about, there are law changes from time to time. There we have maybe talk to an attorney every couple of years to see what's going on. For example, when we were at an unknown situation going for years because we didn't know what the exemption amount, the personal exemption amount, was going to be. I mentioned 10 years ago it was $600,000. It's a lot different planning goes on when it's $600,000 than when it's $5.25 million today. So there's things that can change. We still always, in order to save estate taxes, do use something called an AB trust. We still use them, but it's not ready for a tax scenario anymore. And their idea was to use both persons' exemption, especially when it was $600,000 or $1 million and you had a reasonable size of the estate. You didn't want it all to go to the surviving spouse and waste the first exemption. Well, now in the new law, it's what's called portable. So even if you don't use it at the first death, the surviving spouse, by filing appropriate documents, can use the decedent spouse's exemption, so it doubles up anyhow. So change, laws change.
Steve, I think we'd all like the comfort of hearing the answer to this from you. Nowadays, with many property values going down, there is no step up in basis. And so I assume you can keep the older, higher basis and not have to step down to the new basis.
Sorry. It's going to be the fair market value or of it at the time, not higher.
I didn't understand any of what he was. That was a total foreign language to me.
Okay, well, Pammy, you understand tax basis? When you buy an asset, you have a tax basis equal to its cost, basically. If you buy a home 20 years ago for $100,000 and you luck at all, it's worth more today. So if you sold the house, you're going to pay, ignoring for a minute the exemption on houses, but you would pay a tax on the gain from $100,000 to say it's worth $300,000. It'd be a tax on $200,000.
That percentage would be what?
Well, whatever the capital gains rate is at the time. Well, under Obama here, we just went up to 23.5. So what Jim was asking is, suppose you bought it for $300,000 and now it's worth $200,000. As you pass that house on to heirs, what's their tax basis? And he was hoping it was $300,000. It's not. It's $200,000. It's the fair market value.
For people who feel they cannot afford a reputable attorney, and I've talked to many Christians who feel they cannot afford it. Do you have an alternative suggestion for people like this who might, you know, be only making $30,000 or $40,000 a year?
All attorneys are reputable. What are you talking about?
But they're not all affordable.
Oh. Well, there's a depends upon the estate. I mean, there's a number of things that I've mentioned here that don't require much. You can use beneficiary deeds, payable on death accounts. It depends upon the estate and who you want to transfer property to. You know, there's a lot of tools that don't have to be that sophisticated.
You mentioned in your living trust
creditors, and a living trust will not protect someone from vesting a property in a living trust. And I think there can be confusion among lay people about that, about a top-down and a bottom-up from the creditors. Could you?
Are you talking about, I guess I'm not really quite following.
If you have an existing mortgage on a property, a home, and you throw it in a trust, the mortgage doesn't go away. The creditor's still there.
Yes.
However, if you have a living trust and there is a judgment against you being a bottom-up creditor, they don't have the same opportunity to get at your assets.
Yes, they do.
How?
Absolutely. Because you have the complete ability to take that house right back out of trust. If you put it in, you cannot shelter your own assets from your creditors. Not in this state. There are, I think Nevada is trying to play with that.
If you put it in the trust prior to a creditor having a judgment against you, you shield it.
No, you're not.
No?
No. Because, again, you can take it out. They can make you take it out. Okay? Anything that you can do, your creditor can basically do. That's not true for, as I said, beneficiaries. If you put some asset into a trust and your child and whatnot inherits that asset, and as long as it stays in the trust, their creditor can't reach it, but yours can.
Steve, we're at the end.
Okay.
That was fabulous. It was just, I mean, I looked back at the audience and thank you.
Thank you.
So much. It was just, I mean, everybody is very attentive, so thank you. What I like about Steve is he gives simple answers. And before you rush out, I know we're going a little bit over. I wanted to thank Steve so much what I like about Steve is he gives simple answers, direct answers, and I'm thankful for that. Christopher, could you stand up? Christopher Warrington is a seminary student at Phoenix Seminary. He also does website design. I'm giving a little commercial for him. He's designing a website for Steve, and he just did a cover design for a new book for me. He did a great job, so he's just here this morning, so thanks. Anybody needs any internet work, there's Christopher. Thank you, Steve, very, very much.